The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 595 for Sunday, March 6th, 2016. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in cool stuff found, questions, and tips. We share your cool stuff found. We answer your questions. We share your tips. Together, the goal is to learn at least three new things each and every time we get together. This episode is sponsored in part by PDF Pen Pro from Smile at smilesoftware.com/geek, Casper at casper.com/MGG, where MGG saves you $50 off of a new mattress, and Harry's at harrys.com, where coupon code SHAVE5OFF saves you $5. We'll talk all about those and many, many other things very, very shortly here. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairville, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
I suppose it's better to say here in Durham, New Hampshire, USA, I'm Dave Hamilton, because we have many international listeners. There's no reason to assume that, I think everybody knows when we say Durham, New Hampshire, Fairfield, Connecticut, that we imply USA, but it could also be taken as we don't consider our international listeners. And actually, that's quite untrue, as our international listeners know. So how are you today, Mr. Braun? Assuming that you are, in fact, in the United States of America.
Yeah, I actually added that to my Twitter profile a while ago. Fairfield, Connecticut, USA.
Earth.
So people know what country I'm in.
Milky Way.
I don't think that's necessary yet.
Or for our intergalactic listeners.
Yeah, haven't heard from them yet.
All right, let's go. Let's dive right in. Let's see what we got here. George writes, it's a cool stuff found week, so we've got five or six things that we'll blast through here. He says, I came across something called Haze Over. I can't remember where I heard about it, including the possibility it was on MGG. I don't think so. This sounded new to me, but, it's been 10 and a half years, so what do we know? Almost 11, in fact. He says, it's an inexpensive Mac app that can dim non-front windows. It's very simple and has just the right simple controls. And it is. It's built for helping you focus on your work. Right. So you launch Haze Over and it sort of blurs out. It's like adding focus in a way. So cool. Thank you for sharing that, George. Good stuff. Good stuff. And George is a premium listener. So thank you for that, too. And on the premium listener front, Pam says, I hope all is well. I recently came across this amazing hard drive SSD diagnostic monitoring utility called DriveDX. Not sure if you've heard of it before, but it's fast and gives me very detailed stats, much more than any other utility I've used. There's a free trial and it's $20 for a single license, $40 for a five pack, and other pricing for commercial use. It's worth checking out. And Pam is a very respected member of the Mac Geek Gab community. She has been providing us great tech geeky details like many of you do over the years. So when Pam is one of those who, when something like this comes along that we haven't heard about, it's still worth checking out. So did you check it out, John?
Well, we have mentioned it, Dave, in a roundabout way.
Okay.
I'll tell you how.
Yeah.
Because these are the good folks that actually signed. Remember we were talking about that SAT smart driver?
Yeah.
This is on the same page for that product is a place where you can download the signed SAT smart driver. So normally you can only obtain smart parameters from a drive on your SATA bus. OS X does not include the capability to do this on a drive that is external. But there is a driver, and it's a open source, but the problem is the person that made it didn't sign it, and with the increased security under especially the latest OS, if a driver is not signed, it's not going to load. So these guys took it and actually signed it, so you can, and it complements their software nicely, I think, because they can do the monitoring not only of your internal drive but your external drives
until you set this up. I totally remember you talking about that, but didn't realize that it was the same Binary Fruit folks that did it. So very, very cool, man. Very cool. Thank you for that. Okay. Moving along to Keith. Keith said, I wanted to leave a review about the new Belkin screen protector. I live about 100 miles away from the closest Apple store, so about a week ago when I was near an Apple store, I stopped and inquired about the new screen protector for which they have a machine to place it on your phone. As per the Apple store, everybody was very helpful. The machine was more of an aligning jig than a machine. However, the store associate brought it out to a table and very carefully removed my old screen protector, meticulously cleaned my phone, and then placed my phone in the jig with the new screen protector. And just a few seconds later, the screen protector was applied and it was aligned perfectly. He says, I've been strictly a fan of Zag Invisible Shield screen protectors before. I like to use my phone with a very minimal case, the Apple silicone case. So I'm always concerned about adding a little extra protection for the screen. The new Belkin screen is just beautiful. It's perfectly smooth optically, almost imperceptible, and a joy to use on the touch surface. So, yeah, this is Belkin has created, as he said, it's like a tray that holds the phone in exactly the right position so that the screen protector can be applied. And Belkin says that it is a bendable glass that this thing is applying onto your screen. So, I'm a big fan of glass screen protection. They call it Invisiglass, and is a flexible glass that has been engineered with Fluid Flex technology to give it a unique elasticity. So that sounds good. And it sounds like Keith likes it. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But yeah, the Apple stores, many of them, you can go, we'll put a link. The link will have, easy for me to say, the link will have a way to find stores that have them. So there you go. Thank you. Thank you so much, Keith. And to Scott. Scott writes, I'm going to recommend a program that is more expensive than others, but I just found to be very useful. If you are a Mac user doing research that involves old or copied documents, where the documents may be scanned pages from old publications and where the pages have tables, images, and other elements that are not straightforward, then I have a program for you. Abby FineReader Pro for the Mac is a phenomenal program. I'm doing research that involves old government publications and documents rather than going to a library. I found copies of the documents online scanned from the original. In some cases, like Google Books, there's a version from their OCR, but the capabilities are primitive. Government documents have tables, exhibit pages, and some of them are in landscape mode. Many of these pages have headers, footers, page numbers, and other elements that if you cannot control them, will find themselves in the middle of the text. Not with Abby FineReader. After downloading an imaged 1869 congressional report over 200 pages long as a PDF, I ran it through Abby FineReader for the Mac, and using only the default settings after a bit over 2 hours, the document was fully converted with a very good representation as a Word document. So this is pretty cool stuff. It's I think it's about $120, but if you need something that's very meticulous at its scanning and all that, then that's there you go. So thank you very much, Scott. Good stuff.
You know, Dave, I've used that software in the past.
Really?
How, may you ask?
Yeah.
Well, actually, a little while ago, I did a review of a Fujitsu ScanSnap S1100, which, in my humble opinion, is a fine scanner. It's very small form factor. But at the time, so a heads up to people is that a lot of times the scanner manufacturers will bundle. I don't think they bundle the Pro version, but they did bundle a version of Abby FineReader Pro.
And, interesting.
And they've been around for a long time. They have some pretty decent OCR.
Yeah.
So if you're buying an image scanner, you may get a version of this, maybe a baby version, bundled with it just to make it useful.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty cool. Yeah. So, interesting stuff. All right. Moving on to Michael. This is truly falls in the category of just cool stuff found. He shared with us an email he got from Western Digital that they have new 8 terabyte helium sealed hard drives. And they say this technology reduces internal resistance for improved performance, optimized power consumption, and greater capacity. So A, it's cool that we've got 8 terabyte hard drives out there. And B, it's even cooler that they're helium sealed. So I mean, I guess it, you know, helps things move around in there. What do you think about this, John?
Last I heard, helium is in short supply, so you gotta be careful with that. Huh. Don't go inhaling it from balloons right. and stuff. That's just a waste.
Yeah.
But I know that certain gases, in certain environments can do good things. I wonder who at WD thought of that. Oh, let's put helium in there and see what it does.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm going to add this in because it's just cool. It has nothing to do with the Mac, but I love it when tech comes around like this. I recently took part in a study that Bauer, which is they're a sporting goods manufacturer that make gear for people playing hockey and other sports too. But anyway, they've got this new product coming out, which is built to help reduce the impact of minor traumatic brain injuries. Right. And the way they stumbled onto this thing is they studied woodpeckers. And they said they asked, why is it that a woodpecker can bang its head against a tree repeatedly without suffering any issues? You know, what is it about the woodpecker's physiology? And the answer is there's nothing about the woodpecker's physiology except that its tongue is long enough that when it goes to bang its head against the tree, it actually wraps its tongue around its neck, putting pressure on its jugular vein or whatever its analog to its jugular vein is. And essentially increasing by putting pressure on the jugular vein, it causes less blood to drain out of the brain, keeping the pressure a little bit higher in the brain, which then helps to cushion the brain when the head is doing all this banging. So they've developed this little, it's like a collar you wear around your neck. It kind of goes around the back and comes to the front just past the jugular. And it has to be, you have to buy the right size for you. And it's not out yet. It's still in clinical trials, but it's public. You know, we can talk about it. But very, very cool stuff. I mean, just, you know, I love things like this where it's this simple solution. And it does. They say it keeps about 5 cc extra blood in your head and it helps to cushion things. And obviously the studies are being done, so they can't really talk about the efficacy of it yet. But it sounds like it's likely to be effective if they've gone this far with the product development. So it's just cool stuff. You know what I mean? Woodpeckers. Who knew? I didn't know they wrapped their tongues around their necks. Did you?
No, I mean I've just heard them and on occasion gotten pictures of them and
really they do?
Yeah. Wow. I know.
I'll have to get a video and verify that.
Yup. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy. So, yeah, the next time you're banging your head against a wall solving a tech problem, just apply a little gentle pressure to your jugular vein to keep yourself from hurting your head. They're hurting your brain.
But no, it is an interesting area because I know that concussions and all that in both, you know, pro sports and any sport is bad news, man. Because
it's bad news. Yeah. Yeah.
If you don't detect it, then you can't treat it. And I guess, that's had pretty negative effects for certain people, like up to and including death.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's
brain
not
damage
just
at the very least,
and it's not just concussions either. It's having a child who plays hockey. This is something we've researched. It's the concussions are bad, but you're usually aware of when someone is concussed, right? Because there's these obvious instant symptoms and all of that, and so you know to sort of deal with it. The bigger issue is what they call MTB or minor traumatic brain injury when you've got this small little hits like in football, right? You know where every play, it's not just maybe once every season you might get a concussion, if that, right? In like hockey. I mean, my son has never had a concussion from hockey. But with football, every play you've got these little hits, because you're that's part of how the game works. And so it's that kind of repetitive minor injury that they're looking to solve with this woodpecker band. So and anyway, it's cool stuff. Couldn't resist. All right. Back to a much geekier topic. Jason writes, he found two videos. One is a 9-minute video that does a great job, he says, explaining public key encryption, something we all should understand. And then another one explaining RSA encryption. So we'll put both of these in the show notes. And it is good to watch these things, you know, especially understanding how the public key one, especially, and we've talked about it on the show, and maybe we've explained it well enough for you. But, you know, the concept of using two keys, and they're paired, but one can be shared with anyone because all it can do is encrypt data. And then the other one is what you keep private to decrypt data and all of that. And really how, you know, when you encrypt something, you're not encrypting the whole data package with the person's public key. You're encrypting it with a session key. And then the session key is what's encrypted with the public key. It gets very complex, but really not that complex if you just take your time through it. And 9 minutes is the fastest I've seen it explained well. I think when we tried to do it on this show, it was about 15 or 20. So, you know, there you go. So we'll put those in the show notes for you. Thank you, Jason.
How I learned.
How did you learn?
I learned in the trenches, man. Yeah, well, I was writing code.
Yeah.
This is back in the 90s. I actually was using the RSA BSafe software toolkit.
Okay.
And so I was actually writing it as it was happening. So that's another way to learn. You know, learn how to develop software and then get a crypto toolkit and go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's exciting stuff, though. Now, just writing, you know, and doing it properly. I mean, I was working with some really brilliant mathematicians and security people, and watching them like analyze the security and like especially finding when it wasn't done right. That was, I still remember we actually at one point was using, remember the Clipper chip? This is going.
Oh, yeah. This,
it was a, well, we actually wanted to use some of its functionality. And so we actually ordered some. We wanted to use its random number generator because that's very important for proper cryptography.
Sure.
And we got some. And one of our like math crypto guys, you know, and so we were using it and he was like, you know, this is wrong. And we found out they actually gave us some that were in like test mode. They weren't actually running true random number generation. They were actually running a pseudo generation when they shouldn't have been, because we got back to them and we're like, guys, your random number generator sucks. And they're like, whoops. Yeah, we gave you the wrong product. Let's just give you the good one.
Wow.
Huh. Okay. That's a bit too much detail, but yeah, it's always good to understand the fundamentals of all this stuff here, especially in light of certain things happening in the world.
Exactly.
Always happening.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I actually put up an article this week. We'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Oh, that was good. Yeah.
Yeah. There has been a lot of talk about how Apple holds the keys to some, but not all of the data that you store. And more specifically, it was iCloud backups that have come into the news just because of this San Bernardino case. And people were asking, well, why does Apple hold the keys to my iCloud backups? And so I put together a list of lots of services that we use, including Apple's, but also Google's and Dropbox and things like that. And most of these cloud services that we use, certainly not all, Backblaze and CrashPlan give you the option of using your own keys, even though you're storing on their servers. But most of the cloud services that we use are using their own keys to encrypt the data, which, as I like to call it, means that it's secure until a subpoena. And again, on the surface, you would say, why is it that you want to do that? Well, the answer is convenience, right? You know, we live on this continuum between uber security and ultimate convenience, right? And the thing is, you know, when you get a new iPhone and you log in to your iCloud account and magically your backup is able to be restored to your iPhone, well, how do you think it got decrypted, right? Well, the answer is Apple has the keys. Now, they only will use the keys once you've authenticated yourself, but it's still encrypted with their key, meaning if someone gets access to Apple's data store, either through legal or illegal means, and thus far we believe it's only been through legal means, but then they can, Apple can decrypt that data for you, whether they choose to or not is a whole other story. And Dropbox is the same way. You log into Dropbox on a new computer, and magically, it's able to sync down all your data from Dropbox's cloud. How? Dropbox has the keys. You know, if you back up with Backblaze or CrashPlan and use their keys, well, then you can restore by just authenticating to your account. However, if you use your own key and you go to restore, you have to also then provide the key. And I will tell you, if you do not know that key, you will not get your data. there is no step two. They cannot recover that key for you. And so that's, it's an important distinction, and it's important to understand why we want Apple and Dropbox and companies like that to have the keys to our data if we want that level of convenience. So it's just, you know, so I put that article up to kind of put it all in the context as succinctly as I could. Any thoughts on that, John? Yeah.
No, it's the keys are long enough where brute forcing one is not a conceivable option for most entities,
right?
Yeah, like you said, it gets into that. This is what PKI, which is public key infrastructure. This is a whole. Well, that's the topic. Right. Is managing the keys is a hard problem to do properly, and a lot of times you have to err on the side of convenience, as you said, because if you lose the key, there's no way. I mean, a lot of these are 128 or 256 bit. You're not going to brute force that. You're done. You're finished.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Sometimes having someone hold on to the key that you hopefully trust is a viable option.
Yeah. 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 It's just how it works. You know, I always equate it to, all right, it's easy to equate it to your house, right? You can choose to live in a house that is nothing. You can just brick up all your walls, right? But then you can't get in or out, but easily. And of course, no one else can get in or out easily. But maybe you want to put a door in so that you can get out. Well, that means somebody else can get in, right? And maybe you want some windows because you like to let the sunlight in and see outside. Well, okay, now that's another, you know, potential attack vector. And you kind of have to decide, well, what's more important to me? Where on this line? I don't just want to lay all my stuff out in the yard when I leave, because that makes it easier for people to take it. You know, where do you want to live on that line? And your digital life is the same way. That's how I think about it anyway. All right, John, we have one last cool stuff found, which then also will become a question. So Pete, take it away.
Hi, Dave, John, and Pilot Pete. This is Pete from Wisconsin. Currently listening to MGG 593. Great show, by the way, guys. Thanks for doing the podcast. But I got a cool stuff found, or a comment for the activity monitor discussion, and also a question. Question is completely unrelated, but I'll start with the CSF. Activity monitor, there is actually a keyboard shortcut for quitting a process, Option Command Q. I use that quite often when I'm browsing sites like Ars Technica or Mac Observer. If there's anything that's Flash related, I tend to kill that plugin as quickly as I can get to it, and that's always a great keyboard shortcut to have at hand. The question is about routers, specifically wireless routers. I'm completely changing, well, not completely, but pretty well completely changing my home network scheme. Right now I just have not the latest generation, but the previous generation Airport Extreme. It's been serving me pretty well, but adding a couple more devices to my network, including a new 21.5-inch Retina iMac. I was wondering what you would have as a suggestion for a new router. Been kind of looking at the Netgear R7000. Wondered what your thoughts were on that, or if there was anything else that you would recommend in that specific price category. Thanks again for doing the show, and here's where you cut me off.
All right, we'll cut you off. No problem. So for routers now, first, thank you for the keyboard shortcut to Activity Monitor. I actually shared that with my daughter when your note came in, and figured I would share it here as well, because it is handy to know that you can do that right from the list. So good stuff. As far as routers, the R7000 is a tried and true router. A lot of people are happy with that. It is, I don't want to call it older technology because it's not, but it's been out for a couple of years. There's nothing wrong with that. Like I said, it's tried and true. If you want something newer that might serve you well for several years, not that the R7000 won't, you kind of have to start thinking about how big your house is, how big your coverage area is, and possibly considering a tri-band router, which allows you to do things like I'm doing, where I use the second 5 gigahertz band only for my client my distributed system, right? So I've got two other access points in the house that are dual band connecting to the second 5 gigahertz band of my main router, and that's their backbone. It's not Ethernet anymore. I explained this a couple of weeks ago, but I'm not using power line because the 5 gigahertz stuff is actually faster when you've got two routers talking to each other. I'm getting anywhere between, say, 250 and 400 megabits per second, depending on which corner of my house I'm shooting it to. And so that's how I'm getting my network spread across sort of the corners of the house. And then those second routers that are just dual band routers are only broadcasting 2.4 gigahertz. So the 5 gigahertz band between the two routers is dedicated to just that pipe, and it keeps things from getting slow and, you know, all of that crazy stuff. So if you might need to do that, depending on your setup, then consider a tri-band router. And there's several of them out there. I'm using the Netgear R8500 at the moment, but you know, there's others. D-Link's got several that we're going to be checking out this year. And, so there's that. And then if you want to look at some of the newer tech that's on the dual band router side, because dual band might be enough for you, you know, dual band is going to be enough for most people. And that what they call the AC 1900 range, which is AC 1900 is when you add up the speeds of the two radios, the maximum theoretical speeds of the two radios, you get to 1900, right?
Which is what I got.
Yeah, right. So you've got
one of them. So the TP-Link. So another line I could recommend looking at, and actually I know a lot of the Mac cool kids are very happy with this one. So at one point, Wirecutter actually recommended the TP-Link Archer C7. I got the C9 because it has some slightly different features, though I think the performance based on their tests was not quite as good. If you're looking to squeak maximum performance, but for me, it's fine. You know, it has three antennas, gigabit USB ports, 2.4 or 5 gigahertz and 802.11ac. And I'm quite pleased with it. And the price, I mean, it was like, you know, 100 something bucks. I mean, I don't think you can go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the beautiful thing is I think for most people, you know, I've said and will continue to say that this year is the year of the router. And the R85 I'm typing our show notes and talking here. The AC 1900 range, which is what you're talking about there with yours, the Archer C8 and the or C9, I guess, is what you've got, right?
And the C7 was one that was recently endorsed.
So right.
The whole TP-Link Archer C79. And similar.
Yeah. But that, you know, that AC 1900 range of the R7000, your thing. And then there's some new ones coming into that, that market that I've really been impressed with. One is the brand new Netgear, the brand new Linksys EA 7500. And that's an AC 1900 router, but it will do what's called Mu MIMO or multi-user MIMO, where you have multiple streams available and clients that also support the standard, and there aren't many yet, but they're coming, can connect simultaneously to your router. So right now, the way MIMO works, which is multiple in, multiple out, obviously, or more work simply said as multiple streams on any given radio, means that you can have one client talking over multiple streams to the router. And that's how, even with, you know, 2.4 gigahertz, you can have each 802.11n stream only does 150 megabits. But if you have three streams, well, now you can do 450 megabits, right? Or if you have four streams, you can do 600 megabits. And that's how these routers work. In fact, that's how the 1900 routers work. They have four streams of that. And then they have the 1300 at 5 gigahertz with 802.11ac. And now you add those together and you get 1900. But if your client, like my MacBook Air, only supports two streams, then all I can get out of that router at 2.4 gigahertz is 300 megabits per second. And that means when my computer's talking to the router, those other two streams lie dormant. Well, with multi-user MIMO, as long as the clients and the router support it, those other two streams could be used for another client simultaneously. And that's where things start getting really interesting. And, it's what needs to happen in our homes is we've got all these devices talking all the time. So The Linksys EA7500 supports MU-MIMO. And again, that's something you might want 2 years down the road, 18, maybe even a year down the road, as more and more of your devices start to support this. On top of that, their interface is outstanding. Really, really nicely done. I've been really happy testing that one out. So I can definitely recommend that. Another one is Synology's new router. It too is a 1900 router. And it is outstanding. The interface on this, it's called the RT1900AC. It's the best interface I've ever seen on a router, hands down. There's no question about it. They're new to the router game, but they're not new to the network connected device game, right? They've been building these disk stations for a long time. So there were some, you know, hiccups as they kind of got this router rolled out. But having, you know, a decade plus of web-based UI knowledge go into building the web-based UI for this router. And it's not just web-based UI knowledge. It's like enterprise-grade web-based UI knowledge, because it's how Disk Station Manager works. And it's really, really deep and robust. You've got this gorgeous interface on the Synology router. It makes things really easy to get to, really, really configurable. But just like the Disk Station, there's so much to it that there's stuff I haven't even found out on my Disk Station. And, you know, I've been a Disk Station user for 5 or 6 years now. So the router interface is the same way. It's an RT1900AC is the model, but it's the only router Synology makes. And so that's another one to check out. It does not yet do MU MIMO, and I don't think this one will, but that's worth checking out too. So some new ones, some new entrants on the market as things get interesting this year. So I just wanted to throw those out.
You know, I just did an upgrade yesterday, Dave.
Yes.
Well, it was at my parents, and typically when I go there, so we call a kids' dinner, which is basically, you know, me and my sister and my parents and maybe brother-in-law and some other family get together and just hang out, and a lot of times I'll bring along some of my older technology to upgrade them. So actually, I upgraded them from the AirPort Extreme 802.11 and third generation to fourth generation. Because I have kind of a selfish goal, is that I'd like to get better speeds. And basically, the difference between the two, so number one, I got to give, you know, hats off to Apple and a lot of the other vendors too, but they make it real easy to migrate. So basically, you want to be sure if you're going to migrate, you know, most devices, that you export a configuration file. So dude, this was like, I did this like in a minute. So I exported the configuration file, put the new one in, imported. And the difference between the two is that the old one was, I think, 2x2 and this new one is 3x3. So.
So
everybody gets better speeds.
That's good. That's really good. Yeah. Oh yeah, and probably better range too, right?
One would think. looking at them,
yeah,
it was again. They hit the third generation, so that's going to go to the recycling. And fourth generation is the last Apple 802.11 then that I had, and I figure I'd give it to them.
Sure. Yeah.
So, when I looked at Mac Tracker, the major difference between the two, so they both, you know, support 2.4 and 5 gig and all that. The major difference that I could tell between the two is that, again, the fourth generation Apple product is 3x3. So in theory, you can get what, 450 megabits, I guess? Or six at that.
3x3 is 450. That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Whereas their old one, I guess you could get 300 in theory.
Yeah, it was a 2x2.
So it makes everybody happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
My dad has an iPad, and then I got the iPhone, and my brother-in-law, he's got an iPad. So, you know, the TiVo, you know, their TiVo is tied in on 802. So starts adding up.
Yeah, it does. That's the thing is, right, even if you rewind 18 months, we just didn't have as many devices, not only using wireless, but using lots of bandwidth with wireless, right? We've got our phones uploading pictures. We're streaming Netflix at the same time. You know, there's just so much going on that you really need a router that can stand up to the challenge. Yeah.
And the other thing is that so they were getting phone calls and they didn't understand quite what the person was saying. But basically Comcast was pestering them saying, your modem's ancient. You need a new one.
OK.
So I checked it. I checked, you know, the DOCSIS status page, and they had a DOCSIS 2 modem. And it's like, oh, OK. So they lease it like a lot of people do with Comcast. And so, you know, I called them up and said, yeah, can you ship out the new one? Because they, oddly enough, don't manage their account online. They're old school.
Sure.
They get a bill every month. They get their internet, their TV, and their phone through Comcast. They get a bill every month. They write a check. Yep, a check, believe it or not. And they've never managed their account online. At some point, I'll get them to do that. But I was able to get through somebody on the telephone and say, yeah, okay, here's the address. And they knew who we were because we were calling from, you know, their VoIP.
Right. Right.
And they're like, yeah, well, we'll ship out the product. You know, it's a self-install kit. And so they'll get DOCSIS 3, which one would assume, like when I upgraded, that they should get better. Even though they get good speeds now, 30 down, 5 up, I'm sure they'll get much better once they get the DOCSIS 3 modem.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a friend of mine call me this week, and he said, you know, I'm having problems with, he had just a service outage, which happens to all of us occasionally, you know, and he said, yeah, you know, Comcast has been telling me to upgrade my modem. I think it's just a scam. I think they just want, you know, and I'm like, well, are you, you know, do you own your modem now? He's like, yeah, I own my modem, but they're telling me I need to upgrade. I think it's a scam. Well, what kind of modem is it? Oh, you know, how old is it? It's probably, you know, 6 or 7 years old, but it works fine. Like, okay, what have they been saying? You know, did they send you emails that said you should upgrade? Yeah, but I think it's a scam. Okay, well, here, let's talk about your modem. And like you said, it turns out to be, I think he had a D3 modem, a DOCSIS 3, but it was, you know, a 4-stream modem. And in order to get the speeds that Comcast is pushing to most people, you need an 8-stream, I think. And so, you know, we did the math, and I'm like, look, you know, you're paying for speed you're not getting because you're using this slower modem. And so he's like, oh, so you really think I should upgrade? I'm like, yeah, but Comcast is telling you this. You know, he's like, well, they're always trying to scam me. Like, okay. You know, no. So Comcast has a bad name with people. Some people, I've actually had mostly really pleasant experience with it, but you know, we always have problems. They're our service provider. So there's always something.
I did too. Yeah. My only concern is that I think what they're going to do with this one is they're going to, by default, though you can request them to not do this, I think they're going to enable a hotspot by default, because actually when I was at their place and I fired up my phone, I actually did see Xfinity Wi-Fi on my phone. So I'm sure they're populating their, they already populated their neighborhood. And the good news is actually for me is that there's like a cross licensing between my ISP and Xfinity. So actually I was able to log into that Xfinity hotspot.
Right.
Though, you know, the speeds weren't as good as the one that was right there. But yeah, so in this case also, they're going to get, they're almost guaranteed, and I see in our chat room here from our, I won't call them, the peanut gallery at MacGeekGab.com.
Stop wringing your hands, John. We can hear you wringing your hands.
Oh, gosh. wow, that mic is good.
Yeah.
But Brian Monroe says they should be getting 50 or 70 down and 10 up. So their modem is definitely holding them back. Because, yeah, like I said, I measured 30 down and 5 up.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
can't wait and hope they'll... yeah, and as he said also, you can request that they disable the Xfinity hotspot.
Actually, you can do that yourself. You can go into the online interface and change that. And then you can also go into Comcast's interface and disable the routing functionality of your cable modem if you truly want it to be just a pass-through device and run your own router and all of that. So there may be another visit to your parents' house, because if they send them what they are likely to send them, it's going to be a all-inclusive device that does routing and wireless and all of that. So actually it may work better than the router you just gave them. So you might take the airport out of the mix, but either way, you're going to need to go and remanage this for them. And it might be better to have them, you know, totally in Comcast world. They're not geeks like us. They don't necessarily need the tweakability of things. Not that Apple offers you much in the way of tweakability, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So be aware of that it might not be a 10-minute swap out.
Again, especially if they make it, because right now, as far as I can tell, it's a pass through. It's just a cable modem. It's
right.
Acting as a router.
The new one will not be.
The new one Yeah. So then we get double gnat. So maybe I'll have to turn the airport into a, put it in bridge mode or something.
Yeah. Or the other way around. What I did for my dad was I, you know, he had a router that was working very well for him and had some features that he was using. And, you know, it made sense for him to keep his router. And it may well make sense for your parents to keep theirs. So I just went into Comcast interface and put the router in dumb mode. And then it was like, okay, fine. You want me to turn off my radios and my, you know, just essentially be a bridged cable modem like the old thing was? No problem. And you can do that.
I'll send them a note, because the thing is that they said that you have to call them to activate it, I guess, to provision it.
You know, yeah, you got to give them the MAC address. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So while they're on the phone with that person, I may tell them, okay, you know, tell them that you have an airport and you would like.
You're going to have to go do this. Trust me on this.
No. All right.
It'll be easier for your parents. Yeah. Yeah. You're heading them down. They're going to be asked questions. You can prep them for some of the answers, but probably not all of them.
All right.
Yeah. 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 But it's fun. You know, you get to see your parents again. That's not so bad. All right. You know what I want to do, John, is I want to talk about our sponsors. How's that sound to you?
Fantastic.
All right. Our first sponsor today is Harry's at harrys.com. And I have a story to tell you. We were recently down on vacation in Florida and my daughter said, look, I got to go to the drugstore. Can I get you anything? And I had like some, I don't know, stuff I needed to get or whatever, but it should have cost like, you know, $15 or whatever. And, you know, because I have Apple Pay and she was using my credit card, I saw this charge come through for, you know, like almost $50. And when she got back, like, whoa, you know, how much did you spend on this stuff? She's like, oh, your thing was only like $15-$20. I'm like, well, what was the other money for? She said, well, I told you I needed to go get razors. And I'm like, yeah, but she's like, razors are expensive, dude. That's what she tells me. And she's right. For $25, she got like a tiny little tube of crummy little, you know, shave gel or whatever, and a 5-pack of razors that she was going to use like one of and throw away or whatever because they weren't all that great. $25. That's what she was railroaded into spending at the pharmacy. Well, I told her, I said, look, you know, we got to get you on the Harry's train because check this out. You know, for $15, I can get you a Harry's handle, 3 blades, the nice travel cover, and either, you know, foaming gel or the shave cream. And she's like, did you say 15? And I said, well, yeah, but you know, we have the coupon shave 5 off, shave the number 5 OFF. So we shave $5. So it'll be 10. She said, wait, I thought you said 50. I've seen you and Lucas use that stuff. I thought that stuff was like $50. I'm like, it looks like it's $50, doesn't it? No, it's $15, but you don't even pay 15. You pay 10. And it's shipped to you for free. Coupon code SHAVE, the number 5, OFF. These are the best razors you're going to use. And it's the best price I've ever seen for any razor, let alone razors of this quality. You folks have to check this out. Harry's.com. Remember that coupon code, SHAVE, the number 5, OFF. Not only does it save you $5, that's how they know we sent you. So it all works out. Win, win, win. Our thanks to Harry's for sponsoring this episode. Speaking of very useful blades, our second sponsor, Smile, has the Swiss Army knife for PDFs, PDF Pen, and PDF Pen Pro. In fact, PDF Pen Pro is like the knife with so many tools, it can barely fit in your pocket. But the beauty is, it actually does. PDF Pen Pro has all the tools to add like signatures. You can edit text and images inside of a PDF. If that doesn't blow your mind that we live in a world where you can edit that stuff, it should, you know, because that's how it is. It can perform OCR on scanned documents, and PDF Pen Pro can export in Microsoft Word format. So you start with a PDF, you do some edits, you share it as a Word document. This is pretty good stuff. Only PDF Pen Pro can create interactive forms. It can build you a table of contents. It can set document permissions. Ever open a PDF and it says you can read this and you can do a little bit to it, but you can't do other things? PDF Pen Pro lets you create those. You can go get a free demo for your Mac go to smilesoftware.com/geek and you can get a free demo trial of PDF Pen Pro 7 right now. This is one of those pieces of software. I don't use it every day, but when I use it, I need it. Can't live without it. You probably can't either. You'll find out by going to smilesoftware.com/geek. That's where you can download PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro 7 free trial demo. Our thanks to Smile for sponsoring this episode. After all that shaving and cutting and PDFing, you're going to need a good night's sleep. And our third sponsor, Casper at casper.com/MGG, is where you're going to go to get the mattress that's going to give you that great night's sleep. You're also going to use coupon code MGG there to save you $50. Now, here's the thing. Casper engineers this awesome mattress, right? They build it. They've tested it. They've perfected it. I should know, I have one. It's outstanding. It's the best mattress I've ever used. This thing should cost probably $1,500 for a king size mattress of this quality. It's got all kinds of different foam. It's got memory foam to cradle you. It's got latex foam to make sure you don't get sweaty. It's like all this stuff that they've thought about so you don't have to. It even comes in a box that's engineered really well, makes it through all your doors. You open it up. It's got this cool little like letter opener, and they tell you exactly where to put it, and you slice along this easy little piece of wrap, and then boom, the thing opens up and you're good to go. You've got to check this out. But like I said, it should be $1,500. It's not. The king size mattress, the most expensive mattress that you could possibly buy from them, is $950. But if you've been paying attention, you know that coupon code MGG brings that down to $900. Gets even better. Free shipping in both directions if you decide within the first 100 nights that you don't like it. So it costs you nothing if you order this thing and decide, yeah, you know what? It's not for me. I know you're not going to decide it's not for you. Frankly, Casper knows that too. But hey, it's your call and 100% your call. No risk at all. You got to check it out. Go to casper.com/MGG. Coupon code MGG saves you $50. You get free shipping in both directions. No risk to you. Check it out. casper.com/MGG. Coupon code MGG. Our thanks to Casper for sponsoring this episode. And with that, John, I want to get into, we've had a couple of, you know, meandering conversations today. I want to intentionally make this one meandering. Listener Phil writes, I have a mid-2012 MacBook Pro with 16 gigs of RAM and a 500 gig SSD. I'm looking for settings to maximize my battery life. I do most of my browsing with Chrome and Safari. Also, I was wondering if I take out the DVD drive, would that help battery life? So short question, but lots of information here that we can go on, and then we can kind of just, you know, kind of move out and talk about other things that help our laptop battery life. I will start by saying, first, I don't think removing the DVD drive is going to have a remarkable difference. What do you think about that, John?
No. One thing I'll mention where you can monitor the relative power consumption of your MacBook is the wonderful iStat menus. And that they will show you several of the voltages, and that's part of power consumption. Of course, power is current times voltage, but it also shows the current draw of several of the circuits within it. So you could, and it also actually shows the draw of the processor. So you could use that to empirically determine, but I sense that, yeah, I mean, if the DVD drive's not running, it's drawing a minuscule amount of power.
Right. Yeah.
And if any at all, it may actually be in like a sleep mode and actually be not drawing anything at all. I don't know. Well, yeah. It probably has to be drawing something if it's plugged in, but nothing, nothing consequential.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
Okay. So we're in agreement there. Going with what Phil has told us here, SSD drives, sometimes it depends on which SSD you have and how new it is and all of that. But sometimes SSDs can draw more power than their rotational counterparts. It really, you know, it's kind of all over the map, but it's certainly not out of the question that an SSD would be drawing slightly more power. And actually, in some cases, I remember in the early days of SSDs, we found some drawing quite a bit more power than their rotational counterparts. But to me, that's a worthwhile trade-off, but maybe not for you.
Yeah. Well, you can get the, I'm glad you mentioned that, Dave, because I am looking in my iStat menus and it shows an HDD, which I'm going to guess is hard disk drive.
Yeah.
And it's showing that mine is currently drawing 0.17 amps, which I think is quite miserly.
Yeah.
But as you pointed out, the thing is that I think the current draw in the power, same thing, kind of power draw in a lot of hard drives is the motor.
Right,
because it's got to spin a motor, and yep. that takes power. Whereas, you know, an SSD is typically memory chips, which I would say, you know, may, as you pointed out, Dave, my experience has been that SSDs typically being memory devices, if it's good memory and efficient memory, will typically draw less power.
Yeah,
they could draw more. I think some of the earlier ones did.
Yeah.
I mean, you can look at the specifications, and they should give you that number.
All right, so let's talk about software. We'll assume the hardware is going to stay the same. It's either a negligible impact to change it or too great of an impact. I mean, even if his SSD is drawing more power than his hard drive, he's not going to change because an SSD is going to give him far more benefit and pleasure than a rotational drive. So let's talk about software for perhaps a little bit. He mentions that he browses with both Chrome and Safari. My experience on both my laptop and on iOS is that Chrome draws about twice the juice that Safari does for a similar task. Now, I mean, for simple web browsing, this is, again, probably a minimal delta. Even if it's double, it's, you know, very little power. But if you're doing things like that involve, say, Flash, or, you know, any kind of, certainly Flash. You know, Chrome bakes its own build of Flash into it, whereas Safari uses the Flash plugin. I have found that for whatever reason, the Flash in Chrome causes my fans to spin a lot more in my laptop than Safari does using the Flash plugin.
Really?
Yep.
And you use the Flash plugin? I actually listened to our good friend, Mr. Gamut, who I thought was a raving lunatic.
He is.
Saying he should remove... but in a good way. Mm-hmm. But actually, I took his advice. I uninstalled Flash on both my computers.
Sure.
And when I do need... And, you know, I kind of shake my fist now at sites that say, oh, you don't have the Flash plugin. What I do is I will run Chrome because Chrome has Flash baked into it.
Yeah, but
so that's my strategy, and
but it is not the most power efficient strategy.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So if you're doing a lot of that stuff, and I honestly forget if Netflix is still on Flash or if they've moved, but even still, even like I guess it's Silverlight, right? That Netflix uses. If I can't remember, I don't watch a lot of Netflix in my browser.
Microsoft Steel.
Yeah. But I think that's what. Any whatever Netflix uses, it's more efficient on Safari than it is on Chrome, like by a long shot. Because my kids watched on their laptops a bunch, and it's way better. I can't remember which one uses which because we have Amazon Prime as well and all of that. So I get confused as to which one uses which plugin. But it's just faster, and it shouldn't be surprising. You know, Apple tweaks Safari to work extremely well on Mac hardware because, you know, they control the whole widget. And so you get a lot of, you know, my guess is it's not the processor intensive things that are any different. I think when you need to use the CPU, you need to use the CPU. But I think what Apple does with Safari is they say when you don't need to use the CPU, tell the CPU immediately, right? You know, whereas Chrome might say, well, we're going to need it again. So just, you know, whatever. Don't worry about it. Just go. It'll be fine. And I think Apple's a little more diligent about saying, yeah, go sleep. Okay, wake up. Go sleep. Wake up. You know, that kind of thing.
But Dave, I want to give you the big picture. Can I give you the big picture?
Yeah, go. Oh, and John in the chat room is saying that Netflix is now HTML5, which makes sense. And again, Safari is really, really power efficient at that. So that makes sense. Thank you, John. I knew there was lots going on. One of them's Flash. One of them's Silverlight. One of them's with Hulu in the mix. I think one of them is HTML5 or I don't know, but yeah. Safari's better in terms of that stuff. So other software. Go ahead, John. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you a piece of software that's going to help you determine what other software is chewing your battery.
Sure.
And unfortunately, it's built. And I'm going to say that there are two places to look.
Okay.
One for kind of a short-term look and one for a longer-term look. So if you run Activity Monitor, you're going to see a number of tabs. One tab is going to be the CPU tab. And if you sort by percent CPU, well, guess what? The thing that is consuming the most CPU is drawing the most juice, at least from the processor's point of view. So you may want to look at that list and see what's drawing the most power. Like right now, you know, I got a pretty efficient, you know, what is it, i7 or i5 in here. And actually, I'm running at a very low CPU utilization right now because I'm not, at least on my MacBook Pro. I mean, the thing right now is showing drawing the most juice is kernel task, 1.8%. But then over the longer term, and they added this category, which gives you the bigger picture, long-term picture, is if you go to the energy tab, you're going to see energy impact and average energy impact. And likewise, we're talking energy, power, right?
Yep.
And the things that have the highest number, like in this case now, I'm going to look here, and the thing that has the largest average energy impact, which I think is over a 12-hour window, or I forget exactly what the window is, here, actually, oh, look, Spotlight. Not much I can do about that. But you may see processes in this list here, and it could either be, you know, software that needs an upgrade or stuff that you didn't know was running that you may want to quit. It could be background tasks and stuff like that. You know, like I'm looking here and I see, you know, Google Drive. All right, yeah, that has to draw juice because it has to talk to the network. iStat menus, little snitch, DD assist. So between the CPU and the energy tab, that's going to tell you what your pieces of software, which of your pieces of software are using the juice.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I'd forgotten about the energy tab to do this. And one cool thing in the energy tab, if you sort, you know, you sort either by energy impact, which is sort of the real time display. And then as John pointed out, average energy impact, which is over time. And perhaps, I guess both are valuable depending on what you're looking at. But, like Safari, you can twist open Safari and see the energy impact of each of your browser windows or tabs. So, you know, I can see I have Synology.com is open because we were talking about, you know, the RT1900 AC. So I just still have that website open. And that's for whatever reason, there doesn't seem to be anything weird going on with this page, but that's using the most of any browser tab. Now, it's not using very much. It's using like, you know, it's an energy impact of 4. I don't know what that means, but it seems pretty low compared to the rest. But I'm going to go ahead and close that tab because why not? And then it just goes away. So you can keep an eye on that stuff. That's handy, man. Good stuff. I like it. I like it. I like it.
I've also found, so I also use kind of in real time, will tell me how much battery is left, but I love fruit juice.
Yep.
It's a really nice utility, but it also gives you a count, which you can get elsewhere, but I choose to have a display. This just shows you how much battery you have left. And one thing that I've noticed, Dave, is if you don't need a network drive mounted, unmount it, because that's generating traffic if you're connected to a network drive, or at least I found in my case, is that if I unmount a network drive, all of a sudden my time remaining will start to creep up.
Really?
So another tip. Yeah, well, I think just in general, I mean, there's network traffic, which takes energy. In my case, wireless traffic. I would think it's probably less of an impact on a wired network, but on a wireless network, definitely. Because if you're connected to a network drive, there has to be a discussion happening almost constantly, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's got it right. It's got a, yeah, there's some sort of keep alive transaction happening. Huh?
So if you don't need a network volume mounted, eject it or get rid of it. No, I found that it's noticeable. And like I said, I've seen my estimated, you know, battery time left actually go up when I've kicked off some network drives that I don't need.
Huh?
So
yeah.
So another friendly tip there.
Yeah. Yeah, quit.
And I always say cloud services too. If you don't need to be running the client for them, which, I don't know if I'll take that back or not. But you know, I mean, like I run, you know, I mean, I'm running Bitkasa, Google Drive, you know, a few other cloud services, and those the same thing. They're having a discussion.
Yep.
Well, you'll see them show up in the things I told you about earlier in Activity Monitor. If they're having a real big discussion, then you'll see them. You should see them show up in either CPU or Energy Impact.
Yep. Yeah. Wow, very good stuff. God, I love this. I'm glad we had this chat. This is good. This is good. All right. Let's move to Mike. And then after Mike, let's do Dave and see where we go with that, John. So
sure.
Mike writes, you know, I'm going to rant for a second about mail. When you go to create PDFs in mail these days, sometimes it takes the message and embeds a scroll bar, an unmovable scroll bar into the PDF. So you can't read the entire message. It's kind of a pain in the neck. It did that to Mike's, but I can read it because we just got lucky on this one. But you got to look in the preview of mail and see if it's adding this weird scroll bar. And if so, you hit cancel and then you go to create a preview again and it's gone. It's a bug that's been in mail for, what, 2 OS versions, I think, now, John? People are ranting all over in the Apple support forums. We've tried to solve this. It doesn't get solved. Anyway, Mike, he says, I have a weird problem. Oh, in mail on El Capitan. He says, if I search or do almost anything in mail, search, look at a different folder, etc., other than move from mail item to mail item within the folder, I get a preview. So he has his mail in three pane views. So he's got his folders on the left, the contents of the folder in the middle, and then the preview or the message itself on the right. In the middle window, it shows who the message is from, the subject, and then he has it showing a three-line preview of the message. It's fine. You can configure all that in settings. What's happening in his second column, if he does this search or really anything, is instead of the contents of that taking up the full width of that column, it takes up maybe a quarter the width of that column, leaving the remaining three quarters of that column blank. And as you might imagine, that's frustrating, Mike. So I went and I did some looking. And as you might imagine, other people have experienced this. And they say that going into, so it's mail's, essentially, it comes down to this. Mail's sandbox is dirty, right? So you've got a clean mail.
Well, all sandboxes are dirty by definition, right?
Well, maybe Mike's mail sandbox, maybe the cat has been playing in it overnight.
Ugh.
Right. So, yeah. So I think it's time to punt on mail's sandbox. So here's the thing. We got to remember where sandboxes are. If you go to your home folder into library, which you can get to by going to the, if you hold down the option key on the go menu in the finder, you'll see library appear. So go to the library and go into containers. This is the sandbox. You're going to want to quit mail before you do any of this, by the way. I always forget that when I'm writing people's emails, I give them all these steps and I have to go back to the beginning. Like, oh yeah, quit the software that we're going to be mucking about with because, you know, hey, it's important. So quit mail, then go into the containers folder and find com.apple.mail. Here's the interesting thing. Apple doesn't quite follow their own rules with mail. They store some of the stuff in the sandbox, which is here in home library containers. They store other stuff in just home library mail, which is not sandboxed. And that's where your mail data is, your actual mail store and all of that stuff. If you go into home library containers and find this com.apple.mail folder, that has a lot of your preferences in it. But they're rebuildable. So what I will suggest is instead of just deleting that com.apple.mail folder, just put it on your desktop. That way it's not gone. It's just over there. And when you relaunch mail, it'll rebuild that sandbox and whatever the cat did in there is gone because you've put the other sandbox over there. So that's typically the solution to this problem. And it's weird because, you know, we all know to look in home library mail for mail stuff. We forget that there's this container, this sandbox out there as well. And if you look in the sandbox, it's got a lot of symlinks and such to the, you know, the other mail folders and stuff. So that's how it's all linked together. But you're not going to be likely aren't going to be deleting anything you care about. But that's why we just move it out of the way before we bring it to the dump, so to speak, if we're going to extend this analogy. What do you think, John?
I actually had to fiddle with containers the other day, and actually it had to do with the Fruit Juice software.
Oh,
for some
okay.
reason, an update was failing.
Yeah.
The App Store said, hey, there's an update for it. And I'm like, yay, that's awesome. And it kept trying to download it. And then it said, sorry, an error occurred. Try again.
Yeah.
And it was an endless cycle. And I eventually found a solution, which was to go into the containers folder and I think whack anything in there that had to do with Fruit Juice. And then all of a sudden, worked great. It's very weird. I don't know how it got in that state. And I don't think it was anything that Fruit Juice did wrong. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sandbox gets filthy dirty. You got to clean it up.
Yeah, it's filthy dirty. That's right.
That is a tip to people. If you have App Store problems, it may be. Yeah.
Yeah, anything from the App Store, it just by design, is going to be storing, I believe, all, certainly some of its data in a Sandbox. And again, the Sandbox is, if it's worth looking. You'll see the way they do it. If you go into, you know, home, library, containers, and then pick any one of these, and you can pick the mail one that we've been talking about, you know, com.apple.mail. It doesn't matter. And you look in here, you'll see a data folder. But inside that data folder, you'll start to see things that look familiar. In fact, eerily familiar. You'll see desktop, documents, downloads, library, right? Movies, music, pictures. It looks like your home folder. And that's the idea, is they've sandboxed this. So they do have symbolic links out to the things that they're not touching, right? So like desktop in the mail one goes to my desktop, right? Great. No problem. So we have the same desktop folder. Same is true for downloads and movies and music and pictures. But in the library folder, well, that's not linked out, right? And then inside there, some things are linked out and some things are unique to it. And that's where this gets really, really confusing. And it's easier. It's, you know, like anything, you're looking for a needle in a haystack. But in this instance, you probably just move it out of the way and have it generate a new one when you relaunch. That's what all the recommendations were. I don't have this issue on my machine, so it was impossible for me to test. But yeah, Sandbox is, it's always good to, we said it when they first introduced sandboxing. We are going to forget about this and we're going to have to remind ourselves. So here we are reminding ourselves again. You want to take us to Dave, John, or at least just talk esoterically about what you went through with Dave?
Yeah, and Dave's still going through something.
Okay.
But to discuss, because I think in the security realm, it's important to talk about this. So Dave's a developer, and he's got a MacBook Pro running Mavericks, which he knows he has to upgrade that. And he's also running something that I had not heard of, NGINX.
Yeah, Nginx. It's
Nginx.
Probably the second most popular web server out there, open source web server, compared, you know, with Apache being the first.
Okay. All right. And you can, and actually I, you know, downloaded and compiled it using Package Manager.
Sure.
You should be able to do with any Package Manager. And here's his issue. All right, so use it for development. The web server listens on port 8081, which is not unusual. You can have a web server listen on a port other than the standard ones, which are 80 and 443. Right?
And when you're doing development, that makes sense because on your home connection, Comcast and most ISPs block inbound attempts to port 80 so that you can't be running a web server. And there's security reasons for that, too. So it's totally, like you said, totally common to run it on a standard, non-standard port.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. And he says he wants to test a website with his iPhone. And that means either disabling the firewall or opening up port 8081 for inbound TCP connections. My bottom line question is, how do I open up a port in the firewall on Mavericks and El Capitan? And here's where it gets and then he says, all right, so I have the standard
application. That's the gist of the question is I have these inbound things. I want to manually configure my firewall on my computer so that it still is a firewall, but I want to let connections into this particular port. Is that essentially what he's doing? If we take Nginx and all that other stuff out of it, that's the question he's asking.
And that's
right?
Essentially the question.
Okay.
And then we'll get to a quick primer here on firewall. So first off, what is a firewall? A firewall is a piece of software that will typically block unwanted unauthorized incoming connections. And two are built in to OS X. And they're actually both disabled by default. So you have to intentionally turn them on. Now, one is easy to turn on. And this is the one we'll call ALF. No, not the alien life form that like to eat cats. But it's the application level firewall that is built into OS X. And you can see it and get some details about what it's doing by going to security and privacy, system preferences, security and privacy, firewall. And you'll probably see that it's turned off. You may want to turn it on if you'd like to discourage unwanted incoming connection attempts. That's the purpose of a firewall. Now, if you look at the options, though, you will see a little more detail about what it's doing here. So one, which is a good thing. So one of the boxes here is this automatically allowed sign software to receive incoming connections. What does this mean? And I'll link to an article. Apple explains this more. But basically, it means any software that is from a certified developer or Apple software like iTunes will automatically accept incoming connections because they figure they're legitimate. There's also a list where you can add. So you'll see kind of a mix of things in there. You can actually manually add applications there. Now, right. In this case, so that was one solution that I thought of is, well, let me add, you know, a rule to allow this application to accept connections. Well, that doesn't work, I think, because it's something that you compile and it's not signed. And so I was not able to get it to work with the application level firewall. But for a lot of applications, you may have seen this a lot of times. You may see, you know, you're running and all of a sudden it says, hey, would you like the application blah, blah to accept incoming connections? And if you trust the application, you say yes. And then there's a rule that says, okay, let this happen. So that's one option. So that's one built in OS X. And again, you may want to turn it on to discourage the bad guys. There's also another firewall built in, and it's called, and Apple has changed over time. They used to have something called IPFW, which I guess was Internet Protocol Firewall. Now they have something called PF, which is Packet Filter, but it is also off by default. And the thing is, the two, and actually, if you go to the terminal just for yucks and you type man PF, well, you'll get a manual page from Unix. Oh, no, I'm sorry, you don't. Okay, never mind. Ignore that. So there's also a PF firewall built in, but it's kind of obscure how to even access it because it's off. Now, you can enable its options from the command line. So like one is like, I think PFCTL is one command.
Okay, and there is a man page for that if you want to.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So PFCTL, so the one command off the top of my head. So if you do sudo PFCTL dash info, I think.
Okay.
Let me see if that's right. Or is it dash S info, I think. That's it.
It would be, okay. Yeah, dash S space info. Yeah.
Okay. And that'll show you the status of the PF firewall. And like I said, normally it's disabled. So it'll show you the status. It'll show you if it's enabled or disabled. And it'll show you some interesting statistics about the firewall. Okay. That's all well and good. You can also use this PF control to, again, enable it, disable it. And then here's where it gets kind of squirrely, is that if you want to set the options for it, normally you have to manually edit this file in /etc/pf.conf.
Sure.
And then this gets incredibly technical because you got to learn PF speak, right? And I don't know PF speak. Do you know PF speak?
I actually maybe
you know some of it, and I think I know a little too.
I this is the first I've heard about PF. I've used IPFW before. I've seen people talk about PF. I saw the email trail coming through this week. I honestly, until this moment, I thought it was some third party firewall that he was installing, and that's why pre-show I was like, man, are you sure you want to go into this? This seems like really corner case, and it, trust me, it is corner case stuff, but it's built into OS X, and that's where it was like, oh, well, we should talk about this at least a little bit. So here we are. Yeah.
Right. So if you want to get more control over the firewall in OS X,
yeah,
you can run. You can enable and you can run PF. But like I mentioned, it's, you know, you're going to have to start. Normally, you have to start editing text files and learn PF speak to define the rules and stuff. And who has time for that? Well, maybe you do, but I got a shortcut, Dave.
All right.
Fortunately, somebody wrote a piece of software called Muris. And what is it? Or I think that's the right way to pronounce it. And it's basically a graphical front end. And you can actually download the light version, run it for free. And it basically graphically allows you to define rules for incoming traffic, outgoing traffic. So for example, you can say, let me define a rule that will allow incoming traffic on this port, which sounds like exactly what our listener would like to do. And then it also shows you the text of that rule. So to me, this is a learning tool. And I see it as it's nothing more than a graphical front end. It's not doing anything sinister. And if it's going to change something in the system, it'll warn you. It's like, oh, would you like me to create a script or a configuration file that'll do this for you? Well, you know, say yes, and I will. But otherwise, it's not doing anything bad to your system. If anything, it's helping you learn PF. And also the documentation is pretty darn thorough. So that's one thing. I would strongly suggest you check out this software if you want to.
Now, I want to. I want to talk about
because it lets you turn. So once you define the rules, you can say, "Okay, enable PF," and
you're done.
And then you can see if what you did is correct, and if it is, then you could, you know, cut and paste that test. But go on.
Well, so when you first started talking about this, I thought, well, I want to talk to the folks at HannyNet, HannyNet. Right, because they're the ones that built Waterroof, which was the front end for IPFW in earlier versions of OS X, and did all these things that you were talking about. And it's like, wow, so now there's two. And then they made something called IceFloor, which was the first PF front end for OS X. And it's the same people, perhaps with others, but you know, Hani El Imam is the lead developer, or one of the two developers. I don't want to say he's the lead, but he's one of the two developers on Muris. So it's the same people that have been developing graphical front ends for OS X firewalls for a decade are the ones that have built Muris. So it is the logical extension or logical continuation of what started as Waterroof years ago, for those of you that have been listening that long and you know, have heard us talking about it. So yeah, Muris is it. Why would you not want to use Muris? Even if you want to learn PF speak, use Muris to create the rules and then go look at the rules it creates and say, oh, that's how that's done. Okay, now I want to do this one little tweak that maybe Muris can or can't do. I don't know. You know, and that's usually the answer.
All right.
So, good stuff,
to
man.
Me, Dave,
nice find.
That's one option.
Yep.
But I'm going to offer you another option.
Okay.
So if you want to host a web server to do development on your system, there's another piece of software that I can recommend for you, Dave.
Yeah.
And it's made by a company that we're all very familiar with. And it's called OS X Server, which currently, under the latest operating system, is... So you can either get OS X Server if you're part of the developer program, which is currently, I think, $99 for 2 years or 1 year. I thought it was 2 years.
1 year.
1 year. Yeah. I think I paid and then they extended mine for some. They changed some part of the plan. But anyway.
Oh, because they consolidated things. Yeah. If you had memberships in multiple programs. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So if you're part of the developer program, you can run for development purposes, which sounds like that's exactly what's happening here. You could download, and I actually have OS X Server installed on my systems here. Yeah. And OS X Server, it's similar to Muris in that it provides a nice front end to things that are already buried in the operating system. And one thing that it lets you enable, Dave, is a web server. Though, you know, at first I was scratching my head. I'm like, why are we using this NGINX thing? And you actually opened my eyes to this. So the thing is, the web server that's included with OS X and the one that you activate if you get OS X Server is HTTPD, which is the Apache web server,
right,
which is a fine product, but and maybe you explained it to me. I'll let you explain it again. Why you may want to not use HTTPD.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's two reasons you might want to use one over the other. One is simply religion, right? You know, whatever you've been raised on and whatever you're comfortable with, you know, that you can make arguments for either one. But we actually use both. You know, we use Apache for a lot of what we do, but we also use Varnish as a front end to that to make it more efficient. We use Nginx as to only serve the images from our ad server. So we're using Nginx as a very lightweight, very efficient, very stripped down web server. It doesn't have to be configured that way. You can, it can do other things. It's actually quite robust if you want, but it's also, it can be pared down and be really, really efficient and simple. We used to use something years ago called Boa, and that was, you know, sort of end of life. And we moved to Nginx, and it's been great. You know, could we run our expression engine thing or WordPress, which was what we're moving to back end at TMO on that? Yes, we can run it on Nginx. There's no reason we have to use Apache, but you know, like I said, it's the differences have, it's probably narrowed more than it's forked, but Nginx can be used to be very efficient. There's people that like it. And again, like you said, it comes down to the language, right? You know, do you know how to configure, do you know how to write Apache configuration files? Do you know how to write Nginx configuration files? Which do you, which are you more comfortable with? Which do you prefer? Well, then that's going to be the server you want to use in 9 times out of 10, just because it gets up and running faster.
Right. And the nice thing, and because it's OS 10, you can, and I actually found this. So it seems that if you enable certain things using OS 10 server, it actually behind the scenes is configuring PEF. So if you enable the website through OS 10 server, one thing it lets you set is permissions as far as who can access it, which, gee, that sounds like a firewall, doesn't it? Which I think is exactly what it's doing.
Right.
And you also, and it also gives you some flexibility. You can extend it to understand PHP, Python, CGI, and some other things. And you can also define, you know, what ports it lives on and stuff like that. So that may be another option. If you're going to be doing, if you're just going to be hosting web pages to test with an iPhone, then you may want to consider using OS 10 server and either throw down the $20, or I'm sure our friend is already part of the developer program if he's doing development work. So get OS 10 server and maybe give that a spin.
So I have two, actually three things to address because the chat room started asking me all kinds of questions. First, Jim D has a great way of describing sort of the surface difference between Nginx and Apache. Nginx does 6 things instead of Apache's 50 and does 5 of them much faster. That's the general school of thought on it. And again, is exactly why we're using the two the way we're doing. So that's number one. Thank you, Jim. That was perfect. Great summation of the differences. As far as TMO, we run Apache, as I said. We run currently a system called Expression Engine as our backend, a CMS called Expression Engine. We are actually very, very close to changing that to WordPress. We've got the template built. There's just a couple of things we need to tweak. And then, yes, we will move TMO over to WordPress. You as a user or reader of TMO may not notice a difference at all. Adam Christensen, who does Maccast, also works for us and does all our programming and all that with us, and he has done a stellar job of porting our template over, so it really works very, very well on the back end. Obviously, those of us that publish there will see it's a radically different interface, and in many ways much, much better for the way we do things today. So yes, we are moving to WordPress. I'll talk more about that as the time comes. Lastly, I've got a better option for you, possibly better option for you, instead of using OS 10 server, which is built into OS 10. There is something called MAMP, M-A-M-P, which is taken off a spinoff in name of LAMP, which is Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP. It's a very common development environment. It's a very common production environment. It is what we use at TMO. MAMP is Mac OS 10, Apache, MySQL, PHP. And yes, all of these services are built into OS 10, but it's not simple to compartmentalize them. You can, if you know how to configure Apache and you want to mess with all that stuff, but MAMP lets you run it as an application. And when you are done with your development environment, you simply quit MAMP and away it goes. Nothing is left running after that. It manages all these services that are there, and you can pick which version of PHP you want to have and which version of MySQL and which version of Apache. And you can have it with the light, version, you can essentially run one configuration at a time with the, you can pay, I guess it's MAMP Pro, and run various configurations and have a whole lot more options. So for a developer, MAMP is killer because it really, it lets you kind of sandbox, for lack of a better term, all of this stuff in a very easy to configure way. And it's what I use here when I'm pointing at our development stuff, because Adam makes me use GitHub and version control now instead of just editing live code on the site, you know, like I used to. So I have to develop here and then push changes and log them and all that. It's much better. He's right. It just, you know, I used to like the living without a net, I guess, except for when it bit me. So anyway.
Yeah. Develop on a live server. What possibly could go wrong?
I have a list, actually. Funny you asked, John. Yeah. You know, for the most part, it's really handy. You just push a change, reload. Oh, looks great. Awesome. We're done. You know, except push change. Hey, how come there's errors everywhere? All right, let me undo and save. Nope, that didn't fix it. Uh-oh. You know, those kinds of things. Yeah, you know, whatever. It's all good. But yeah, MAMP is cool. If you don't have MAMP, John, I recommend downloading the, I use the free version because I don't need, I only need one environment at a time, you know, so it's no big deal for me at all. In fact, I don't know that I would take advantage of anything in the pro version, but except now that we have this simultaneous path going where we've got Expression Engine and WordPress running. So I might actually need to buy MAMP Pro now, which is fine. Yeah. Yeah.
I actually, the last time I needed to do some web development, I actually was pretty happy with OS X Server. And I think it was somebody asked me to write some PHP code. And I'm like, yeah. Oh, look at that.
Yeah, it's fine.
But I get it. There's certainly alternatives. So I think we've covered a heck of a lot of ground here. Okay, so firewall's good. OS X Server good. There's some options for developing web applications or web serving. We just mentioned not one, not two, but three.
Yeah.
Or two and a half, right?
Okay. Yeah. We promised we were going to get a little geekier. Here we are. All right. Well, I believe that brings us to the end of what we're going to chat about this week.
That whizzed by. Like,
didn't. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is where you can send in your questions, your tips, your comments on the show, anything you want to tell us. We would love to hear from you. Right, John?
Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is what I believe you said, Dave.
I did say feedback at MacGeekGab.com, except if you're a premium listener. We had questions from several premium listeners and some cool stuff found as well. If you are a premium listener, you get a benefit there, premium at MacGeekGab.com. That's the box we check first and more frequently, though we do check the regular feedback box at least once a week as we kind of go through and prep the show, and sometimes even more often than that. So thank you to all of you who are premium supporters. We really couldn't do this without you and really appreciate it. You are all welcome to call our new number. Somebody please test this, because right now it's just been John and I, 224-888-GEEK. Which is, John?
And always will be, 4-3-3-5.
Yeah, it's true. Nobody, and that's why the old one expired, because no one was using it, because we have all these other methods now to get in touch with us. So, you know, the phone has become the least, which is, you know, a sign of the times, right?
Who uses a phone as a phone anymore?
Exactly. So, there you go. No problem. But, you know, you can text that number, too, now, because it's a Google Voice number. So if you wanted to text us for any reason, 224-888-GEEK, which, John, is?
4-3-3-5.
Should work. That's right. We would love, I know we've asked for this recently, but I'm going to do it again. We would love to have your iTunes comments. If you haven't left one for us, please go to iTunes and leave us a comment. It won't take you very long, and it really does help us out. That's one of the metrics Apple uses to choose whether or not to feature our show. And the last time you folks went and you know, it didn't take many comments from you, and all of a sudden, you know, we were featured again. So we really appreciate it. New listeners, anybody out there that hasn't left us a comment yet, please go leave one. We appreciate it, and it's good for you too. And with that, I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank CashFly at CACHEFLY.com for providing all the bandwidth for getting the show from us to you. I want to thank all of our sponsors. Of course, the three we mentioned in this show, Harry's at harrys.com with coupon code SHAVE5OFF. Smiles PDF Pen Pro at smilesoftware.com/geek. Of course, Casper at casper.com/MGG, coupon code MGG for $50 off. Gazelle at gazelle.com. Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com. Some of the best hardware and support you're going to find. Of course, Barebone Software at barebones.com. I hope you have a great week. I'm going to be in San Diego visiting Smart Draw this for a couple of days this week. I hope you have a great week. I hope we all have a great week. Hope you have fun. I hope you've learned something. And between now and the next time we talk to each other, I hope that you don't get caught. Made up.